yesterday on the board, you wrote the J matrix.
Which J matrix? Oh, the
For the
so it's
20.
called the Yaroslav invariant.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
then you wrote the J matrix with some canonical delta, and then
Yep.
you wrote that goes like A to the sixth, lambda to the sixth, and I was wondering what the meaning of that concept.
So remember when we took the CKM matrix and when we write it in terms of the V's, it looks like there's nine different numbers.
Yes.
But because of the fact that we have unitarity, which is underlying the derivation of the CKM matrix, many of those parameters are actually related, like VUB is related to other terms. But those expressions I wrote down for essentially this is the relationship that's present. So there's not actually nine independent parameters because there's a whole bunch of conditions.
Yeah.
So what you do when you have the other parameterization, which I told you at one point was called the Wolfenstein parameterization, is that you use these relations, you take one of the elements of this, and then you start to define the other ones consistent with these relations. And then if it's a small number, you start to just expand so that you get simpler relationships between things. So that led to the structure that VCKM was equal to just, 1 minus lambda squared over 2, 1 minus lambda squared over 2, and then lambda minus lambda, and so on and so forth, 1. And then we introduced A lambda squared rho minus I eta up here, and then this was A lambda squared minus A lambda squared. I think this might be cubed. And then this one with 1 minus rho minus I eta. So just taking these individual elements and plugging explicitly in to the Yaroslav invariant in terms of the expression, in terms of the individual v's, you just expand out and you'll find that you actually get the scaling in the powers of A and lambda that I wrote down. So I think I wrote it down as, so the actual scaling is, where is it? Yeah, the actual scaling is A6 lambda 6 eta. So you have to actually work through all of the CKM elements, expand them out in terms of the invariant, and you'll actually find that it has that scaling.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is really small, actually. I mean, it's the invariant that's there that's independent of the phasing of the quark fields, but numerically it's extremely small. So it gives you an idea of why actually observed CP violation is a very small effect in terms of the Steiner model. So those k-on wave functions as they evolve in time have a very small off-diagonal sort of that little epsilon we defined in terms of how they evolved in time. It's a very small effect, but it is measurable, and we actually have found it. So hopefully that's a bit clear. See if people struggle in, but I'll just start talking about this a little bit. So yesterday we talked about the fact that neutrinos have mass is a clear experimental sign that the standard model is actually wrong. Like it's incomplete. I mean, it describes, and we cross-tested in a lot of different ways, and successfully cross-tested in a lot of different ways in terms of flavor transitions and such. But there's a solid prediction of the standard model, which is that the neutrino masses are all zero. And it's just a matter of there's no right-handed neutrino field, so we only have one term in the Yukawas as opposed to two terms for the up and down quarks. And you just explicitly get directly that this is zero. But we do know experimentally, we can look at essentially how the neutrinos evolve in time, in their time evolution, according to the Schrodinger equation. And we look at how they evolve as they get generated in the sun and then arrive on Earth, or also how they basically transition across the Earth itself. Like this is there's two different measurements of essentially their time evolution. their time evolution is sensitive to their mass differences, just like the time evolution of kaons was sensitive to the mass differences that were there for the quark fields. So we know that these mass differences are present, which are measured to be very small. And then we basically got to the point of, well, we have to accommodate that these are non-zero. And if we want to accommodate that these are non-zero, then we need to do something. We'd add something to the standard model and change it in some way to basically make it so that this is actually allowed. So if we want to make the mass differences non-zero, then we need to have individual masses zero. And it seems like the obvious thing to do, which is an obvious step, but there's a subtlety we need to dig into a little bit more, is to just add a term to the standard model which exactly does the job. So just like in the case of the up and the down quarks, we add another term, we add a right-handed neutrino field to the standard model, we add this Yukawa term and its Hermitian conjugate, and it would seem like, there's nothing really to see here. It's going to just follow the usual structure of the standard model in a very direct way. The Higgs gets its VEV, just like in the case of the quarks, then there's going to be a term like this, and this, remember, is something which actually has flavor indices. So it's not mass diagonalized yet, and we want these mass differences. So we introduce, exactly in the same way like the quark fields, an additional rotation matrix for the right-handed neutrino field that we've introduced, so that we take this mass matrix, which is not diagonal to start with, we rotate it, in the exact same sort of way. We have this rotation. We get to the neutrino masses. Now, one of those could still be zero experimentally. We only know there's two mass differences. So we don't actually know there's three, non-zero masses, but we do know there's two mass differences. And then we can accommodate those experimental facts just by choosing these masses to basically fit the data, right? And consequentially, there's also going to be, because there's mass differences, this time evolution, which will be sensitive to the mass differences, will basically allow you then to have the observed change in time of the wave function as it goes from the sun to the earth. Okay. The PNMS matrix is just the equivalent of the CKM matrix in this case, right? It's just a matter of the fact that we had a lepton doublet field that was present, this L up there. And the rotation to the mass eigenstates of the upper part of that doublet and the lower part of the doublet, just like in the case of the quarks, is not the same. So if you go to mass eigenstate fields and rotate to get this mass to be mass diagonal, and the equivalent one for the charged lepton fields, you have an overlap matrix, just like VCKM. And it should have four parameters, you would think, naively, just like VCKM. It would seem like it's exactly the same thing, just all the way through. And it's, nothing fancy to see here. But it's actually a little bit more subtle than that. And there's reasons why people look at this and they say, well, okay, that's a possibility, but it's not the only way things could go. And the reason is because of what we just did when we added this field to the standard model for a fermion. It's actually unlike the other fermions. It's very distinct compared to all the other fermions that we've thought about so far. In the sense that, if you look at its quantum numbers, okay, there's no SU2 index there, and there's no hypercharge, right? So this, the fact that the neutrinos and their mass differences are very small is one thing. That's just an experimental fact. They could have been larger, but they're found to be small. But associated with that is also the fact that the right-handed neutrino itself is rather special in the sense that it is a singlet under all the gauge groups of the standard model. So you might think that those two facts are related. You might think that the smallness of neutrino mass has something to do with its unusual quantum numbers. It's a possibility. It can also just be that the Yukawa coupling itself is a very, very small coupling. But the neutrino masses, these are EV squared. And remember, the other masses we talk about are MEV, so that's a 10 to the 3, or GV, that's a 10 to the 6 compared to this. So it's a much smaller coupling. Now, it could just be that it's a much smaller coupling, and that's just the way it is, because it is technically natural, in the way we talked about yesterday. Like, you do loop corrections. If it starts small, it stays small, and it time evolves or sorry, it energy runs, its RG evolution is such that it stays small. But it is curious that this one is associated with much small masses. Okay? So it's even more curious in the sense of, because of this, it's its own antiparticle, right? Because it doesn't carry a hypercharge. There's no way to distinguish the particle and its antiparticle. Okay, so if you have a fermion that's its own antiparticle, that's what's known as a Majorana. So what we mean by Majorana, let me see. Just to remind you, I'm not certain you guys went through this in the fall. Did you go through Majorana masses versus Dirac masses in field theory? Did you? Did they? They did not. Okay, that's good. I'm going to remind you of this then. Okay, so what's different when you have a Majorana versus when you have a fermion that has a hypercharge? Okay, so let's just remind ourselves of this. In the masses of the standard model that we wrote down, usually with a Higgs getting a vacuum excitation value here, you usually are coupling lefts and rights. And so when you have a mass term for a Dirac mass, then you're just basically coupling together two different helicity eigenstates of the fermion. And these are carrying different hypercharge in general. So that's why you need the Higgs to basically be there to make it so that the overall hypercharge of this, when you have the locally preserved hypercharge symmetry, is not broken. But remember I told you at the start, it's a bit more subtle than that. You can just write these sorts of masses down directly with that sigma field. Remember when we talked about the sigma field, which had to do with the SU2 left cross SU2 right. Not the custodial symmetry one, but remember the sigma field, which had the explicit Goldstone bosons, which was a way of writing down explicitly the masses of the Z and the W. So it's just an exponential. You just want to make sure you remember this. Sigma with some pions, it was over V. Remember this field? Not in the case of the vectorial subgroup of QCD, but like the first week we were talking about that. You can write these sorts of terms down if you put the appropriate sigma field here in a VEV. So you can put these down directly, but then you don't have the local symmetry, the local U1 hypercharge symmetry being preserved, but this is a nonlinear representation of the symmetry. So we can write these down directly, but not if we have a locally preserved symmetry. If we have a locally preserved symmetry, then we have to write something down like with a Higgs. Okay, because these have different hypercharge. So when you add this hypercharge and the hypercharge of this, it's not zero. So if you do the phase transformation for hypercharge, this will break the local symmetry unless you add the Higgs, which has exactly the hypercharge to make it so that these mass terms all work out. So that these U-Cow terms all, you know, have a sum of hypercharge equal to zero. Okay, so that's the usual case in the standard model. But now we have a different beast that we've added, which has no hypercharge itself. So why this neutrino, this right-handed neutrino field we added, of course we can write down the Dirac term and we can have the analogy go through directly like in the standard model as we have written so far. That could be where it stands. But you should always ask yourself as soon as you introduce a new field like that, what else can I write down? Like, you know, just make sure we write down everything. The way the standard model is constructed is up to an exception, which I want to talk to you about Thursday, and maybe I think Monday's the last day we talk. You write down every term you can in the Lagrangian, and that's where it stands, and then you experimentally fix the coefficients. But if we add this neutrino, this right-handed neutrino, which is a pure singlet, then something is interesting is present, which is that we can add another term to the Lagrangian. It's kind of allowed. Okay, so how do you see this? So remember that the Lorentz group really has to do with rotations and boosts, right? So we just usually give the generators this sort of notation for rotations and boosts. It has a Lie algebra. Well, not a Lie algebra. It has an algebra associated with these transformations of these generators, which looks a lot like the SU2 generators. But it's a bit of a mixed algebra, right? In the sense of these commutators give back the J's, and this one just gives back J, and then this is non-zero. So there's a nice transformation you can do in terms of generators. You can define generators, which are the combinations. This I is actually the complex I. Just be a bit careful. So you can combine this combination of boost and rotation generators and this combination. And when you do that, you can actually take these algebra equations, stick these in, and you'll find directly that you, by doing this choice, these Hermitian generators, that you actually break it up into the commutator just returns then the commutator A, and this commutator returns the commutator B, and this cross commutator is zero. So what's nice about choosing those generators is it makes manifest something which otherwise is might, you know, be an obvious or obscure group theory statement, which is that when you have the Lorentz group, that it's like locally isomorphic to an SU2 cross SU2, which just means that this algebra and this algebra is the algebra of an SU2. So there's two different SU2s here. And you can see explicitly in this, you know, literal, you know, generator, simple couple lines of math, this statement that it's locally isomorphic to SU2 cross SU2. So I made that statement at the start also in terms of the generators, in terms of the way we think about the fields, but you can see explicitly that's what that means in terms of math. So the notation you see in the literature at times people talking about this is just that, like, under this SU2 and this SU2, which is the breakdown of the Lorentz group into these two different subgroups, then a scalar is just a 0, 0. So you'll see that in the literature. And when you start to talk about fermions, a Weil spinner, which is just, you know, two component spinner, is just one that has a half. So it, has, it just transforms trivially under one of these SU2s. Okay? It also could be just over here a half. It's just a two component spinner. And usually what we're doing with masses is we're tying up left and right handeds because we have to, because of locally preserved hypercharge, to have mass terms. But the difference now is that you can actually just write down a mass term itself just with this Weil spinner, this two component Weil spinner. Okay? So let's just call this Weil spinner this guy. Okay? So just one of them, which means just that it transforms in this simple way under the rotations and the boosts. This is actually a rapidity, so it's related to the usual boost factor you think about in special relativity by a hyperbolic tangent. So this transformation and this transformation is explicitly the change of this field under boosts and rotations because you've chosen this representation. And you can just check directly that you can actually write down this mass term. Okay, so this mass term, just having the transpose of this guy, a matrix, and then the field itself. And if you just explicitly do these transformations on this mass term, what you'll find, whether it's a rotation or a boost, you'll find that this is invariant under those Lorentz transformations explicitly. So if you look at components here, it's kind of easiest to see this is a transpose, not a dagger. And then it's just, if you look at the components, you end up with a determinant of this transformation M. So it's an invariant mass term. Okay? So that's a bit weird, maybe, maybe not. It's actually the way fermions should be if we didn't start doing things like giving them hypercharge, right? But this mass term is just allowed. Okay, so now it's not so simple, right? So we took the standard model. We have neutrino masses that are observed. We did the obvious thing of taking the mass terms of the standard model for the quarks and adding an extra right-handed field to give masses to neutrinos, just following our nose, just going directly forward. But if we add that term, you also can just have this term. So this just means you can just have the right-handed neutrino mass term itself. It's its own antiparticle. So this thing can just be there. And then this mass scale is just around, right? It could be associated with the electroweak VEV. It could just be its own mass scale. The reasons in the case of the standard model, we have all the masses of the fermions associated with the electroweak scale is, again, because of locally preserved hypercharge, right? Because the Yukawas, there's always a Higgs field there. That's generating the scale. That's the only scale. But now we have a new scale that's possible if we have Majorana fermions like this, while fermions just two component spinners, the ones that are without any hypercharge. So this is a non-trivial step forward in the case of sending the standard model field content. This beast is actually unlike the other beasts of the standard model in terms of fermion fields. So if you just stick to the hypothesis that, okay, the masses we see are just coming like the masses of the quarks with this Dirac coupling, this Yukawa coupling, which is a perfectly fine hypothesis to stick with, you have to make some statement, either implicitly or explicitly, okay, what about this mass scale? Is this zero? Are you assuming this is zero? Is this small? Is this large? What is this? Because it's allowed, and you should take all the terms in the standard model Lagrangian that are allowed by the symmetries and just measure them and just see what they are. And so actually, when we measure the neutrino masses, you have to basically make some choice if this mass term is a large component to what we see experimentally in terms of the masses or small, because you see you'll get a mass contribution just from this, and then you'll get also a mass contribution linked to the VEV. And it's the combination of those things that you'll see experimentally, okay? So whenever you are saying just Dirac masses, you should be careful because you're actually then, you know, implicitly saying this thing could be here, but I'm gonna say it's small. It could be, zero, right? We just don't know. But usually the parameters that can be there are there in the standard model, up to a very important exception we'll talk about Thursday. But so we have to make a choice, okay? And the fact that the masses are so small, you know, it's like maybe we should think through what happens when this mass is not small. What if this mass is big? Okay, what if it's much bigger than the VEV? Okay, what happens then? So if it's much bigger than the VEV, so we have to make a choice. And the choice we talked about so far was essentially this mass, this bare mass, much, much, much smaller than y times v. So we just talked about the case where it was just coming from here and neglecting this mass. But what about, it'll be just Dirac. What about the opposite limit? Okay? In terms of neutrino masses. And that is exactly what the seesaw model is. Okay? Because you know what we should do if this mass scale, which can be there, is much, much larger than all of the experimental scales associated with neutrino measurements. We should expand, Taylor expand, in p squared over this m squared. We should just do that thing we've been doing all the time whenever we thought about the physics of the standard model. This always works, right? So that's what we're going to do. And potentially, people get Nobel Prizes for doing exactly that. This was in the late 70s. People started to think about this sort of thing. We'll see how it goes. Okay, so if that's the case, we know what to expect. So we expect L standard model, which remember has the neutrino masses equal to zero, and then we'll have some higher dimensional operators. We'll have a dimension 5-1 potentially, a dimension 6-1, dimension 7-1, so on and so forth. This will have one heavy mass scale, and in this case, we expect it to be suppressed by m squared, m cubed. This sort of thing is what we expect to happen. It's exactly what happens. And just this operator itself, if we just want to identify it just by what can we write down, we can just look at what's actually allowed, again, because of the hypercharges. Now, it turns out, and I think this is an exercise you're going to go through in detail, that this is actually the one operator in flavor space. So it's not just one parameter that's allowed. I'll just have lambda here because we're not going to assume the particular mass it's associated with. Okay, that's a charge conjugate field with an index m. T Okay, let me make sure I get all my indices correct. Yes. This is it. This is all you got in flavor space. Now it's this thing that you can write down, again, because of the unusual fact of the hypercharge of the Higgs being related to the hypercharge of the lepton doublet. Each of them, remember, had a hypercharge of half, right? Which is also why, when we started to think about this term, that the charge of the right-handed neutrino was, you know, unusually zero. The hypercharge was zero. So when you have H's and L's, you can build this sort of operator structure up. And this is dimension 5 because this is dimension 3/2, 3/2, dimension 1, dimension 1. Okay, so it's a dimension 5. It's the only dimension 5 operator you can write down. Now you can ask yourself the question, wait, where did this expansion go? Where is the right-handed neutrino mass? We're going to get there. But just as an operator extending the standard model, you could also, here's another weird observation. If you didn't think through all of this, you could just say, okay, if I just have the standard model and I just add the first thing I can add to it going beyond dimension 4, what can I add? Okay, just bottom up. Okay, and that is exactly this operator form. And the thing is, when you take this operator form and you take the Higgs to 2 vacuum expectation values, what do you get out of this? Well, you get a neutrino mass. So if you take the Higgs equal, and you work it out, what you'll find is this term gives you minus k with a 2 . So just the two components that were in the upper part of the L doublet will come out of this, but you will get a neutrino mass. And the M will scale as, so it's minus V squared over 2, then this small lambda. You still have to rotate to mass eigenstates. As it stands, this is a matrix in flavor space. These are flavor indices M and N. Okay? And then this rotation, these two rotations are both allowed and necessary. But nevertheless, this gets you then to a mass, a set of masses, which can also accommodate the data that we see in terms of neutrino masses. Now, depending upon the coefficients of C, V, in this case, kind of by construction, lambda, so by, so by assumption, lambda was much bigger than V because that was built into the expansion that we were thinking about writing down here. We're kind of leaping ahead when we were thinking about this being a mass associated with this bare mass term. But this assumption is built in, essentially. So then this might be something that is of interest, right? Because the masses of neutrinos are much smaller. The bigger we make lambda compared to V, these masses then naturally become smaller, okay? So this might be a way to understand why the masses of the neutrinos are so much smaller than the other parameters, the other masses we see in the standard model. This goes in the direction of make lambda bigger and things make more sense, okay? So take the standard model, add something, but add something which is very, very massive. And then the more you do that, when it generates this operator, the smaller the neutrino masses get. So this might be a way to understand the smallness of neutrino mass. So the simplest thing to add is exactly this mass term we were talking about itself, right? So we'll have the right-handed neutrinos. We'll add this mass term as well because it's allowed. We'll add this Dirac coupling, this Yukawa coupling in. And because we're going to take the limit that this M is much bigger, we will then remove that field by doing the Taylor expansion. We'll do this Taylor expansion where P squared over that m squared is much less than 1. And you'll see that what happens very consistently is you generate exactly this in terms of the leading effect. Okay, that's really the seesaw model. This is just something called the Weinberg operator. But when you actually generate it in this way, it's the seesaw model. Okay, so explicitly, so we take the L standard model and we add to it a field which has this M, this index P. Okay, so this is just the mass term that we were allowed to add, that we're going to assume is big. Okay, and then a little more consistently than before, when we just wrote down this Yukawa coupling, we're adding both terms that we actually add when we put this field in. This is kind of the general case, right? And I'm just choosing a sign convention here for the neutrino coupling. Okay, this just has indices B and P plus Hermitian conjugate. Okay, so this is just the simplest thing, right? So if you really add a right-handed neutrino field and you add everything you can add when you add that field to the standard model, you add its kinetic term, you add its mass term, which is allowed, and then you also write the term which we were using to have neutrino masses. Okay, all three of them are present in general. And then consider the case where this is very heavy. Okay, when that's heavy, very similar to the case of muon decay. Remember, in muon decay, we had this with a heavy mass. In this case, we have this diagram. And I need to define something for you here. I should be a bit careful about this. Okay, so this is a total singlet field. Okay, but let me just define, just to be clear, what this LC is, because there's C starting to appear. You have to add the complex conjugate for the lepton field. So did I define it here? So my convention is complex conjugation. So when you see a field with a C, it's C transpose fermion field, where C is equal to minus I gamma 2 gamma naught. It's just a convention of how I'm doing charge conjugation to make the hypercharges work. And you should be careful about this, just because this definition, there's other definitions people use in the literature, and it's also something to be careful of, that when you do like the left or right-handed projection, it doesn't commute with this charge conjugation operator. So just be careful about this in terms of notation. So there's C's that are present here and that were present in this operator form. Okay. But what we're just gonna do is we're gonna take P squared, M squared much, much less than 1. So we know what this will happen. This will shrink to a point plus a bunch of higher dimensional operators. Which is the first operator is exactly that. So when we're doing this, this is in the case of the W, remember we just had 1 over MW squared. It's slightly different in the sense that we have a fermion propagator. So what we're shrinking to a point here is actually P slash okay, and it actually scales as, well, it's minus P slash plus MP, obviously, MP squared, just like in the case of the W, 1 plus so it works out at leading order to be just minus 1 over MP, not 1 over MP squared, just canceling off one of these. Case. Okay. quite straightforward. So that's why it's also dimension 5. Remember when we had the w, right? And we took that p squared minus mw squared expansion, we got 4 Fermion operators. It's just ending up to being a dimension 5 operator, exactly this one. So if you take this, then you saw that this coefficient is then being identified with a Yukawa matrix transpose, a Yukawa matrix over MP. And then if you do further, so the masses from this operator will also get the V squared. Okay, so if you just take the masses, so it's going with V squared over 2 MP then, and then once you diagonalize, it's going with this. So what this tells you is that the mass differences, which are switching now to GVs to give you an idea, because the scale V is associated with GV. So that means essentially that if the Ys, if the coefficients here are order 1, then the masses we're talking about are like 10 to the 16 GV. Neutrino masses are very, very, very small. But could be. So choose your damage, right? Small couplings to give very small masses, which are technically natural, while you simultaneously think that somehow this scale is not going to be large if you have right-handed neutrino masses around, or it's for some reason it's small, we just don't know, and what we see experimentally is a combination of this and then an expectation value of the Higgs, a possibility, or think in this limit that p squared over m squared is much less than 1, do the Taylor expansion, and the leading term tells you if these y's are order 1, a very large mass scale. But of course, you can also choose that these y's are not order 1, they're smaller, and then, you know, if they're smaller, it also lowers this mass scale. Okay, but these are the possibilities that you have. Okay. So, I want to get back to, I wanted to take one, okay. Due to timing, okay, I'm going to do something quick, and I'll flesh it out more Thursday. I just want you to see one other reason why you might think this sort of scale is a good scale, and the fact that you make these mass scales of new stuff very big would be a good idea, which is baryon number violation and proton decay. Okay? And then we'll turn the reasoning around and we'll see that, you know, this is actually can be thought to be bad. So we're starting to get into the inconsistencies of like, well, how do we go forward here? It's not inconsistencies, but just, we have to make choices. Okay, let me just sketch this out very quickly, and because I want to get back to why that scale as it gets bigger leads to something which is challenging. So remember baryon number? So I think what I'll do here is I'm going to sketch this out very quickly for you, and then I will go into more detail on Thursday on this. But just let me sketch to give you the idea of the order of magnitude. Okay, baryon number violation. So remember, you can just define baryon number. Okay, it's defined as a third the number of quarks minus the number of antiquarks. So you can just do a phase to follow this baryon number as a global symmetry. Okay. It's a global symmetry. So, if it's a preserved, then what we expect is the lightest baryon will be stable. Okay? So lightest baryon is actually the proton. And so far, if you look at the case of the standard model and just the dimension 4 standard model, and you basically do these phase transformations, you'll see the Lagrangian classically, L standard model preserves baryon number global symmetries, this global symmetry. Okay? But that's not enough. Potentially, just in the case of the axial current that looked like it was also preserved, that you can have quantum effects which could disturb this story. So you could worry about anomalies. And I am going to go through this in more detail Thursday. I'm just sketching it out for you. Anomalies, which are essentially diagrams like this, where you have this current, a baryon current. And the baryon current, just to be explicit, the way you would construct it is you just take u bar gamma mu u plus d bar gamma mu d for all the quarks. And you could just do these sorts of triangle diagrams, and you could see if this quantum effects are going to start to violate this. That was the motivation in the late 70s, combined with also adding to the, basically building the standard model into grand unified theories to look for baryon number violating proton decay. Okay? So that was the motivation, to see if the proton decays with possibly pions, okay? If that's the case, if these sorts of effects you expect it to be something like g squared over 16 pi squared where is epsilon mu nu alpha beta. Okay, we're going to get back to this in more detail. I'm just getting you to the point of seeing the scale involved with this, okay? So if this was the case, if it's not zero, and if it's giving through these diagrams sort of gamma-gamma decays, you would expect this sort of thing. You can look for it. And they looked for these particular proton decay modes, okay? And what they found is, so this, okay, so, okay, it's not going to be, I'll go into this in more detail Thursday. But the point is, they look for the decay of the proton, and its lifetime was much, much larger than they thought when they actually built the initial experiments in something called a Keck experiment in Japan. The lifetime is 8.2 times 10 to the 33 years. This is the current experimental limit. I might have gone up a little bit more since I looked up this number a couple of years ago. It just keeps going up. We just don't see protons decay. So even though that we could hypothesize, we argue about these instanton effects of whether they'll lead to proton decay or not, in subtleties that I'll get into in more detail. But the lifetime is very, very large. Okay? But on the other hand, in like an analogy to the lepton number violating effects of that dimension 5 operator, you could say to yourself, okay, we're starting to go in the direction of adding these sorts of operators, and the dimension 5 one worked out really well to explain neutrino mass. What can you write down to lead to proton decay in terms of explicit operators? So there's four of them. Okay, that violate baryon number. And so when we have this sort of lifetime, we're essentially getting constraints on those operators. It's kind of an exercise that I think you're going to go through to actually find these operators yourself, but I'll just tell you the answer. There's four of them of this form. They have flavor indices, so these are flavor. And they're kind of weird operators. Due to limited time, I think I'll write one explicitly, and I'll just, in terms of notation. This is the charge conjugation operator I defined. Okay. Q, I, gamma, S, C, L, J, T. So what are all these indices? This one's SU3. So the SU3 index, alpha, beta, gamma. And the IJ indices, if I have them correct, are the SU2. Okay. Yeah, I think I have that right. And then the flavor indices. PRST. Okay? So that's just one of them. There's three others, which I'm not going to write all the indices for. You can work out the indices. There's QQUE, which is just telling you the field content. QQQL. Then there's DUUE. So, I mean, you can construct them in a similar way, just figuring out what you need for the symmetry, anti-symmetry of the actual operator should be non-zero, but this is the field content. And they all have this kind of similar form with these epsilon tensors explicitly there. I'll leave it for you to work out just because of, I want to get to some other point. The point is, unlike the case of the operator that's there for lepton number violation associated with neutrino mass, the limitations on proton decay actually lead to very strong constraints on these operators. So if you have the decay of a proton, it goes as this operator, any of these operators for baryon number violation, squared. It'll go as the proton mass to the fifth power, and it'll go as lambda to the fourth, because these are dimension six. Okay? There's none at dimension five. So you get that. If you stick in the proton mass, take the lifetime, derive the decay width corresponding to these operators, take this coefficients to be order one, you know what you get? You get, again, same sort of scales. We'll as I said, we'll go into this in better detail Thursday. Okay. So, two things seem to be pointing to very large mass scales, light neutrino masses and no proton decay. Okay? If you take the standard model and you extend it to the most popular gut in the 70s, so what you do here is you take SU3 because SU2 across U1 in the standard model, you embed it into a larger gauge group. If you have that larger gauge group, you have gauge bosons and you have scalars that couple to the various things you're putting into a multiplet of SU5. One of those scalars is just a triplet Higgs field that goes along with a doublet Higgs in the standard model, and it leads directly to these sorts of operators, just to give you an idea. So it looks like this. It gets its VEV, it's a T field, and it couples to both leptons and quarks, okay? So it has these charges. It's an SU2 triplet, and it has hypercharge minus a third, okay? And it gets a VEV. So it generates quite directly these operators. So it's telling us also, if you're starting to think about extending this terror model to a larger gauge group, maybe you should be thinking about these high scales. So it seems like everything points to higher scales as the solution to the problem. Not so, you know, maybe it would be good if that was the case. We could all retire, but or do other physics. But, okay, I don't want to do it this way. I want to do it on this board. It's not quite so simple. There's yet another thing that shows up, which basically is curious. Okay? And let me just illustrate it with just this case. Okay? So we have this nice story that we add this heavy mass scale, which is allowed. We take this Taylor expansion, and we get neutrino masses, which are experimentally necessary. At tree level, you get this plus a whole bunch of higher dimensional operators, dimension 5, dimension 7, dimension 9, actually. It's what you actually get. But if you have this diagram, you also have another diagram. You can just take this diagram, and you can close these lepton lines. So if you have this, if you have this interaction term, this interaction term, and you believe this is the origin of neutrino mass, then necessarily you also have this. All right? It's the same diagram, just closed. It's the same interactions, which goes as this Yukawa and this Yukawa. Okay? So, neutrino mass seems to point to make this right-handed neutrino heavy. Baryon number no proton decay seems to point also to this mass scale. But as you start to get this mass scale to be larger, what happens in this diagram? Well, let's just hopefully sketch it out in the calculation very quickly, okay? So what is it? What do you get? I want to do this in detail. Maybe I'll do this in a detail next time also a little bit. So we have L, plus we have this L, this whole theory here. Let me not write that again. So we have this whole theory. And now we're not just going to do the tree-level Taylor expansion. We're also going to do the one-loop effects when you actually take this mass to be heavy. And there's a contribution which is going to go like H dagger H. So what is this? So you basically do the two-point function for H as a function of momentum going through. And let me make sure I do this the same way. This momentum I'm going to route this way. So K is the loop momentum. And what do you get for this? You get a half this coupling is a sum over flavor space. D4K 2 pi to the fourth. Then the trace for a closed fermion loop. K slash plus P slash plus of this right-handed neutrino. The lepton mass, if it's non-zero, and then k plus p squared minus okay, so just this. This is something we can just directly calculate. What do you get if you calculate this? Well, we have a loop momentum here, k, that we're integrating over. We need to combine denominators. So we combine denominators and we want to shift the loop momenta to get rid of, to make it into a nice form. So the shift we do is L minus 1 minus XP. And if we do that, we combine denominators, we get, going to get a 2. Because there's a factor 4 that comes out of this trace. And we're going to get This is now our loop momentum. And it's going to be L squared minus P squared x, 1 minus x, L squared minus delta, all squared. This is just standard doing a loop where this delta is the mass of the neutrino squared, 1 minus x, plus the mass of the lepton squared, x, minus P squared, x, 1 minus x. We can do this explicitly, but you can see how it's going to scale. Two powers of L in the numerator, 4 in the denominator. It's log divergent, so this is going to be an epsilon. And then the mass scales in the problem are going to show up to be what's sitting in front of H dagger H. And the biggest mass scale, by assumption here, is this neutrino mass. Okay. So what you actually get explicitly, and I'm out of time, so I'm gonna have to also go into this next time a little bit more. Okay. So explicitly what you get is the following. There's a 16 pi squared with an epsilon. Minus P squared. Then there's a term. It's 48. The different numbers are just because of the integrals over x are slightly different. I call it this m nu squared. Minus P squared. And then there's some other log terms. So this is an epsilon pole in dim reg. We're doing a calculation in not the standard model, but the standard model with these Majorana fields that we've added. So we have to renormalize that theory. When we renormalize that theory, there's an extra subtraction that we're allowed to do, which kills off this. But there's a finite mass term to H dagger H, which is going as this large mass scale in the problem. And if we basically take the limit where this is the dominant mass compared to the lepton mass, and we think about experiment, this actually has to do with, you know, dH. This is a wave function effect. It's a two-point function for the H field, but it actually is associated with this. It's a finite contribution to the wave function normalization of the Higgs. But the point is, we shift the Higgs mass when we do that one loop effect by exactly this large mass scale. Okay? So what do we get for the Higgs mass? We get, I really want to do this in more detail for you. So then we have L nu okay, and we expand this out. We get minus lambda over 4 v squared h dagger h in the standard model. And we're getting another contribution. Well, with this minus sign. It actually works out to be 8 pi squared at the end of the day. Yeah, that number is a bit interesting. Okay. I'm not sure about that 8. I'm going to have to recheck that. The point is, this also multiplies exactly the same operator form. Okay? So what we see experimentally is this plus this, right? What do we see experimentally? It's whatever is the total thing in front of H dagger H. Okay, so this is what we actually observe as the 246 in this case. And the problem, I'm already over time, I'm gonna stop. So I'll come back to this also next time. The problem is is if this is 10 to the 16 GeV, which seemed to be what was indicated, what the heck's going on, right? So we actually, if this is order one, remember, for the neutrino masses, this is 10 to the 16, this is 10 squared. So we're off by many orders of magnitude. This is what's known as the hierarchy problem, and this is a specific example. This plus this would need to add to what we actually see in terms of the observed VEB, which is 246. So to even make the numbers work, what you need to do is you need to say there's a bare mass, and then there's the renormalized mass in the standard model. And so those bare parameters, you have to assume, will cancel that very high scale physics against that 10 to the 16 GeV, so that exactly what you see, the sum of it, is canceling down to like 14 digits. So that what we actually see is like 246 GeV. Okay? So you can see it in this specific example, but this is generic. Whenever you have new physics that's coupled into the standard model, which has heavy mass scales, when you start to calculate the two-point function for the Higgs, dimensional analysis says that you can get the biggest scale sitting in front of that operator, and that's exactly what happens. So it's not the case that it's uniformly that the problems of the standard model and the standard model itself makes more and more sense the more you make a scale beyond the standard model needed, for example, for neutrino masses, higher and higher. Okay, so I'm over, so I'm gonna stop. I'll come back to this in more detail also next time. I wanted to sketch this, I can actually sketch this out in much more detail. I just, you know, we can go through this in much more detail. So you're absolutely certain this is happening. But if you just go through, it's a very straightforward diagram. And you'll see that this is how it works. You can see dimensional analysis-wise, there's that heavy mass scale here, and just like look at the rough scaling of this. So you'll see that you get this contribution. So if you have any great ideas as to what the heck's going on in reality, this would be the when you can offer them up, because this is where we start to get into our challenges, right? It seems like we want to have that scale as big as possible. But as soon as we start to do that, we then have to say that, well, what we happen to see just for the Higgs mass has this incredible cancellation built in. That seems weird. But then you say, okay, let's make this much smaller and make these coefficients somehow so that you don't get a big contribution to the Higgs mass. You lower that scale and you think, okay, that's going to make my life easier. But then you lead to proton decay problems. You have problems with flavor physics. So on one side, there's a whole bunch of experimental precision tests which are pointing to high scales. And on the other side, there's a need for this magic cancellation to happen in the Higgs mass. The more you make the scales larger, that says you want lower scales. There's a tension here.
But if it's at the level of like bare mass, like why do we care if you don't like observe bare masses and stuff like that?
It's just, okay, so that's a good question. Like formally in field theory, you can have a bare mass here, right? And then what we see also has quantum effects, and you always had to renormalize the theory. You had to fix with renormalization conditions some observed mass. So that's exactly, yeah. So maybe we should just be fine with this. The thing that bothers people is that this doesn't just happen in this model, right? This is a very specific example with just this heavy Majorana mass for neutrino masses. It keeps happening. So like, if you have other stuff in the UV, you have more complicated stuff, if you have some successful unification which makes it so that the baryon number that's induced is not too big, and it has other mass scales, you keep getting contributions. It just keeps happening by dimensional analysis. And so like, if it was like a one-off, you might be, okay. But if it's like, okay, so that mass scale and this mass and this mass and this mass, all the bare mass at a very low scale just happens to be in reality to cancel off all of that. And they're loop corrections, right? It just, at some point it gets to be like, how much cancellations are you willing to accept. And essentially, it's also the problem of the cancellations are associated with very different scales. Right? So we always do cancellations in field theory. We always are canceling off things like the divergences. But they're at like one scale. And there's not a lot of tuning of scales of different physics to basically make physics at some other scale come out so that it's consistent with dimensional analysis. That's technically unnatural, which is what I mentioned to you the other day. It's a technically unnatural sort of thing to do. So you, I mean, yeah, it's like, maybe. Some people who are very, very strong, very serious calculators, they're just like, yeah, okay, reality just has this tuning. It goes, you know, you have to make a choice in terms of what you're going to do. But neutrinos have mass. The Stermal is definitely not enough. And there's other things like you know, dark matter and these sorts of things. There's lots of indications there's new stuff around coupled into the standard model. So, you know, this is the easiest thing is to basically have this scale be basically a loop factor above the observed Higgs mass, right? Things, there's not really magic cancellations if this scale, you cancel off the 16 pi squared, and it's roughly the scale of EV, which basically puts you at the TV, few TV scale for some physics. And that's also why at LHC we're looking very hard to see if like we see anything in the few TV region. Could be just a tuning. Tunings happen.